It's February 17th, 1989, and we're watching Bill and Ted's Most Excellent Adventure. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
This show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood to see if they still hold up or whether we're just blinded by nostalgia. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host,
Colin Stewart.
Now, of course, one of the current trends in Hollywood is to reboot franchises or to make sequels to movies that we thought were dead. So today, to celebrate the release of Bill and Ted Face the Music in theaters now, if theaters are still open, I don't even know, pandemic world, who knows, we decided to do a special show and therefore decide we also needed to bring in a special guest. So today we are joined by my flesh and blood, my own son, Chris Wells. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
I'm excited. Bill and Ted's. I love Bill and Ted's. Okay, so this week we're looking back at February 1989 when the movies in theaters were Major League, The Fly 2, Sleepaway Camp 3, The Burbs, When Harry Met Sally, and of course our movie for today, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which made $40.5 million at the box office on a $6.5 million budget.
And as always, warning for anybody who hasn't seen this movie, there will be spoilers ahead. I mean, it's been out for quite a while.
31 years.
If you haven't seen it by now and you still don't want it to be spoiled, please stop the podcast, go watch it, and come back and listen to what we have to say.
Okay, so the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "History is about to be rewritten by two guys who can't spell." That's it. That's the tagline.
That's pretty fitting.
Yeah, but that may not be the best description, so we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
Yeah, 60-second synopsis. Bill and Ted are high school buddies starting a band, however they are about to fail their history class, which means Ted would be sent to military school. They receive help from Rufus, a traveler from a future where the band is the foundation for a perfect society. With the use of Rufus's time machine, Bill and Ted travel to various points in history, returning with important figures to help them complete their final history presentation.
That sums it up. Yeah, it's a pretty basic plot, but for me, I know watching this movie, it was, I was watching it with my girlfriend, and I was starting to piss her off because I was quoting lines that were coming up. I knew, you killed Ted, you medieval dickweed, and I knew all these lines were coming up. So I love this movie. I've always loved this movie and Bogus Journey. Like, I've watched them countless times, both of them, but I was surprised at how well I could remember and quote lines from this movie. Chris, you're our special guest. What kind of experience do you have with Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? I'm sure you probably watched it for the first time, possibly because of me. I don't remember whether it was me that showed it to you.
I'm sure it was definitely, when I was growing up, I'd always ask you for movie suggestions, and Bill and Ted was probably one of those that popped up during those suggestions, but yeah, no, I've watched it probably half a dozen times when I was little, and then now again, more recently, I watched it twice for this, so I love that movie. It's great. I love it.
It's, I guess I may have shown it to him because I could justify the fact that it's a G-rated movie. Like, did you know that
it's
about
G-rated?
This? It's G-rated movie, even though they use words like dickweed and
incredible,
and they subtitle Napoleon with those shits over and over again. Colin, what kind of experience do you have with Bill and Ted?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'd never seen this movie before.
It's a trend we have on this show.
Yeah, which is becoming a trend on this show. But I mean, I liked it a lot. I didn't know what to expect, really. I honestly think when you suggested it and I went out to watch it, I thought this movie in my mind was Weekend at Bernie's.
Okay.
And so I thought, again, this always happens. I was expecting a completely different movie than what I got, but I was happy for it.
Okay. So let's jump into Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So it's directed by Stephen Herrick, who I never heard of, but has some significant directing credits like Critters, Mr. Holland's Opus, 101 Dalmatians, Three Musketeers, The Mighty Ducks, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, Holy Man, Rockstar. Like, he's got some beefy credits, but he's not a household name, at least for me. Hopefully around the Herrick household, he's a household name. We've got produced by Robert W. Cort, who produced the original Jumanji, the Arrival, Three Men and a Baby, and the one I'm sure he's proudest of, Kazam. You know, gotta get the beatboxing genie movie in there. That's a proud credit. Someone had to have it, I guess. And it's written by Chris Matheson, who wrote movies like Mom and Dad Save the World, Mr. Wrong. He was also one of the writers on Bogus Journey, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. And also written by Ed Solomon, who arguably has much better credits with movies like Now You See Me 1 and 2, Charlie's Angels, like the McGee one, not the shitty new one with Kristen Stewart. Men in Black, he was a writer on Men in Black. So we open, and it's the year 2688, San Dimas, California. We've got a weird golden crystal thing that ends up turning into a phone booth, and we meet Rufus, who is played by the legendary George Carlin, who, if you don't know his stand-up comedy, you may have seen him in Car Wash, Outrageous Fortune, The George Carlin Show. He was a Kevin Smith regular in Dogma, Jersey Girl, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, and of course, Thomas and Friends, where he was Mr. Conductor after Ringo Starr, but before Alec Baldwin.
Oh.
Yeah, George Carlin was Mr. Conductor. I always got such a kick out of the dynamic of, like, this filthy comedian that was the host of Thomas the Tank Engine. Hmm. So Rufus is talking directly to us. He's breaking the fourth wall, and he's talking to the camera, setting up the movie for the viewers, explaining that 700 years ago, the math works. I did it. 2688 minus 700 is 1988. So he was right there. But the utopian present that he currently lives in almost didn't happen because Bill and Ted were almost separated from each other. And then we go back to 1988, and we meet Bill S. Preston Esquire, played by Alex Winter, who is pretty much only known for Bill and Ted's.
Yeah, I can't name another thing he's in.
Yeah, he's always the other guy in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Yeah. He has 27 acting roles. He has 37 directing roles. That's actually where he's kind of moved into these days, is he's more of a behind-the-scenes guy. So he is still busy, just... Yeah, don't expect him in front of the camera very often, except in Face the Music. And then we also meet Ted Theodore Logan, played by Keanu Reeves, who is pretty much opposite in the credit department. Do I even have to mention what his credits are? But in case you've been living under a rock for 30 years, we've got Speed, Point Break, all three, and soon four Matrix movies. Nice. All three and soon four John Wick movies. And so Bill and Ted are jamming in the garage before school and trying to film a music video with just the two of them passing the camera back and forth. And they're questioning their future by getting caught in an idiot loop of logic. When I love their idiot loop of logic where they decide they need the video to be able to get noticed.
They need the video to get Van Halen.
Yeah, to get Eddie Van Halen.
Right. And then they need Van... Oh, yeah. Like
they just, need Van Halen to get, they, yeah, have a triumphant
need,
band.
Exactly, yeah. Just have the most excellent video. We need Eddie Van Halen, but we can't get him without the video.
Yeah.
We shouldn't proceed without telling everybody their band name, which is Wild Stallions.
Wild Stallions. With Ys. With a whole bunch of Ys. With all the Ys. Yeah. Yeah, Wild Stallions, because, yeah, I'm Bill S. Preston Esquire, I'm Ted Theodore Logan, and we are Wild Stallions. That's right.
It's really, though, if you read it correctly, it's Wild Stallions, which I find you.
Basically, yeah.
Especially for a movie that's so based in, like, history and all that sort of thing. I guess that is a little bit fitting. So, they're jamming before school, so
yeah,
why not?
Interesting time to jam. I didn't recall that happening in the morning when I first watched the movie, but yeah, they're just right before school.
Yeah, just before school, and then I guess it's like the figure skaters or the dancers that get up at 5 a.m.
Yeah,
and do 4 hours of training before school, and we follow them into Mr. Ryan's classroom. Mr. Ryan, played by Bernie Casey, who had quite a career in blaxploitation films like Cleopatra Jones and Black Gun, Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde. I'm gonna get you, sucker. And also, he was in Revenge of the Nerds 1, 3, and 4. I didn't even know there was a fourth Revenge of the Nerds. He was also in Never Say Never Again, James Bond.
Is there any explanation why he missed 2?
No, I have no idea. I didn't care enough. and we find out that Ted knows that Napoleon is a short, dead dude. I love them talking to Mr. Ryan in the classroom when they're held back for a second at the end of class, because you can tell that this is Bill's usual suspects moment, where he's just reading everything off the chalkboard. He's talking about, no, we know about what was
Socrates?
No, he doesn't even say Socrates.
Oh, Socratic method.
Socratic method. Yeah, we know all about Napoleon and Socratic method, and he's listing all the people that he knows, and he's just like reading it right off the board. I do love that moment.
I don't know why, but for some reason I like when he asks Ted who Joan of Arc is, and Ted says Noah's wife. I was like,
no, that was a good one.
That's sure. I was like,
he knows something. He's not a complete idiot. He's just wrong.
He just goes back a little bit further in history to refer to a different famous Arc family. Yeah, and so of course they receive this convenient oral assignment about historical figures and how they would react to the world of today. Foreshadowing much? I'm not sure about that. And they're picked up. They're,
The biggest aspect of foreshadowing are if you look at all the historical figures on the
walls
of the classroom, it ends up being all the people that they end up finding.
Yeah, copyright laws prohibited them from putting up pictures of people that weren't going to appear in the movie, I guess. Right. No, I don't know. So they're picked up by Mom, picks them up from school, played by, Missy is played by Amy Stotch, who was in Summer School, 21 episodes of Days of Our Lives. She's got kind of a meh IMDb. I love the reoccurring jokes with Missy about, remember that time you asked her to prom and all that stuff. They keep just drilling it in that Missy is really, really that much longer.
Yeah, from what I looked into, she was a senior when he was a freshman.
Yeah.
So he was in, like, what, grade 9 when she was in grade 12?
Yeah, freshman in the States, that's grade 9. So
interesting.
Yeah.
And even the fact that he always, like, Bill always has to correct himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, hey, Missy, I mean, Mom. Like,
yeah. So Ted needs to grab something from home, and we get a glimpse of his home life. We get to meet Captain Logan, played by Hal Landon Jr.
Yeah, total opposite home life.
Yeah, he's 56 credits to his name. He was in Eraserhead, played by... He played Napoleon in the movie The Artist, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, yeah, very, like Chris said, very different home life. He is, you know, a captain in the police force, but he's busy looking for his keys. Dun, dun, dun.
Foreshadowing again.
And telling him that if he fails his assignment, he's going to send him to Oates Military School in Alaska. And Hal Landon Jr., I am pleased to see that he is appearing in the forthcoming Bill and Ted Face the Movie. He is reprising his role.
Face the Movie?
Face the Movie. Face the Music. Thank you. Thank you for pointing out my stupidity. But I appreciate the fact that he's coming back. Missy is coming back as well. The guy that plays Bill's dad, though, is not coming back.
Is he alive?
He is alive. He is alive. I don't want to spoil Bogus Journey for you. If you watch Bogus Journey, it might make a bit more sense. So we get a cut of the future with all the future people saying to Rufus that it's time. And Rufus gets in his phone booth, and they've got their future version of May the Force Be With You by Be Excellent to Each Other, party on, dude. We hear this phrase at least three times in the movie. It may be more. I know three for sure.
Wonderful phrase.
Yeah. I was wondering what the phone booth, like, had no one watched Doctor Who?
You know, it's just an American TARDIS.
Yeah, could they not have maybe selected a different... I know they thought about using a van, but they thought it was going to be too close to Back to the Future at the time.
True. Yeah. They want something nondescript.
Yeah.
So it's like, what can you have that's nondescript? And, I mean, the fact that you get to have all these visual gags later on of the packed phone booth.
Yeah.
You have to have something small. I mean, the TARDIS... It's enormous inside.
Yeah, it's got like a magic thing about it or whatever.
Yeah, so, you know, you're not going to see people riding crammed into that one.
Love it when it flips onto its side and it's all of them in there.
Yeah,
right. In the time sphere or whatever.
So we're hanging out in Bill's room, getting burnt grilled cheese from Mom. And Mr. Preston, we were introduced to Mr. Preston, who is played by J. Patrick McNamara. He was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1941, a whole bunch of TV. He comes home, kicks them out of Bill's room.
Yeah.
So that he and Missy can smush. Like, it's...
Incredible father.
Yeah. And again, you know, this is one of those places where I think, okay, this is a G-rated movie. I guess the fact that, you know, Ted is sitting there, he's about to plow your mom in your own room. I guess it could be over the head of most kids that would be watching this movie, but it is a little borderline for me.
Just a bit.
And so Bill and Ted decide to go to the Circle K to ask random people walking up to the Circle K to get answers to their homework. And with the mention of the Circle K, it's time for a segment we like to call Sponsorship Corner. Now, as always, one of my favorite things to watch for in these older movies is the obvious product placements. And holy shit, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, You Are My Hero. You did not disappoint in the least. This is a big one. Buckle up. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is brought to you by Fender Guitars, Ford, Scope, USA Today, Goodyear, Hostess Twinkie, Dulcis Shoes, Vision Skateboards, Foot Locker, Speedo, the Houston Astros, Nautilus Fitness, Burlington Sox, Solo Cups, and of course Circle K, because Bill, strange things are afoot at the Circle K. This has been a very long and very satisfying sponsorship corner. Wow, This is the longest list I've ever had. I thought the Goonies was a big one, but this one, wow. So they're at the Circle K. Bill and Ted are ready to try the Thrifty Mart for answers instead, but Rufus lands in front of them, and he's in the phone booth, which I noticed, I took note that the phone booths cost 20 cents in 1989. And
how much does a phone booth cost nowadays?
Oh, who knows?
Exactly.
Last I checked, it was 35 cents.
Oh,
35?
Still pretty low.
Yeah. That was like 10 years ago. So
good luck finding one.
Inflation hasn't hit the phone booths just yet.
Yeah. but even like 20 cents then, and I always remember them as being 25 cents growing up. So, but yeah.
Canadian change for you.
Yeah. I guess so. That's the exchange rate.
Their famous $20 cent coin.
So we've got Bill trying to convince them that Rufus trying to convince Bill and Ted that everything is okay, and trying to tell them what his mission is. And other Bill and Ted show up, and so of course we have some of the famous lines, of course, here where they're trying to figure out whether they're really them. And would we lie to each other? And okay, if you're really us, well, what number are we thinking of? 69, dude!
Classic.
That's right, classic. And of course, the classic, Ted, don't forget to wind your watch. give our loves to the princesses, all that sort of thing. So they now believe that, okay, Rufus is the real deal. They get into the time machine. Rufus gives us the line, "Gentlemen, we're history," and the circuits of time take them away. The circuits of time are a little cheesy now, but still not too bad for a 1989
very effect. Early CGI from what I'm aware of. Like one of the first movies, I'm pretty sure. Not one of the first, but like definitely one of those early movies that were using CGI at the time.
Yeah, it's not too bad. And so now part of the reason why my son is on the show today is because his university career has taken him into history. So this is where we're probably going to get some insight into how accurate the history of Bill and Ted's is. We first land in, Rufus is showing them around Austria, 1805, where we meet Napoleon. Napoleon is played by Terry Camilleri. He was in Superman 3. He was in Geely. He was in The Truman Show, and I remember his scene in The Truman Show. He was the guy in the tub. If you've seen The Truman Show, you know, when Truman decides to walk out the door, he's the guy in the tub that's just cheering about the fact that he's getting out. Yeah, and so this is where we meet Napoleon. So Austria, 1805. Did Napoleon invade Austria in 1805?
100%. I forget the exact war that he's fighting, but he was in Austria at 1805.
This is not Waterloo. With all the references to Waterloo, this is not Waterloo.
He's on his way to Waterloo, as far as I'm aware. This is during his 100-day empire or whatever. After he was first banished from France, he came back and raised an army and took on the French, the British, and the Austrians, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay. There we go.
Well, not the French, sorry. The British, the Austrians, and I don't remember. There was a third one.
So Napoleon decides he's going to wage war on the phone booth that he see when he sees it, and ends up getting like blown into the hole and sucked back to 1988 with them when they leave.
One thing I didn't understand, I don't remember specifically what it is that sets the explosion off behind Napoleon, but what I do remember is that sparks fly in that explosion.
Yeah,
and I don't. Like, what would have been launched at that point that would lead to sparks flying?
Yeah.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know. Yeah, that is a good question, though. But it's flashier. You gotta have a flashier. So, yeah, Rufus warns them back in 1988 that the clock is always ticking. This is one part of the time travel that I don't quite understand why there is a constant clock of back home.
Exactly. I was wondering that at the beginning of the movie, is there's a deadline that they have to meet, even though they can play with time however they want, apparently.
Yeah, which ends up melting your brain at one point in this movie, the amount of time travel that they're going to be doing at one point. But yeah, Rufus leaves, and Napoleon falls out of the tree, and so they decide to ask Ted's little brother, Deacon, played by Frasier Bane, who has 4 credits to his name. They decide to get him to babysit Napoleon while they go and start surfing through time. But on the way out of the house, Ted is stopped by his dad, already having signed him up for military school, and Ted is not supposed to leave the house, but he's saved by Deputy Van Halen because Bill has realized that Ted is trapped, and he phones and calls as Deputy Van Halen, saying that he has found Captain Logan's keys, and we get it driven home a little bit more that, hey, by the way, don't forget that Ted's dad is missing the keys. Captain Logan takes off. Bill and Ted go out. They get into the phone booth. Let's reach out and touch someone, they say. And first stop is New Mexico, 1879, where the phone booth lands next to an outhouse, and we get some good old fart jokes. 1879, do you know Billy the Kid? Mexico, 1879, does that sound accurate, or is this one that you don't know?
Not very into the American frontier, unfortunately, but as far as I'm aware, he was a cowboy. So they
everything I learned
nail in the head.
Everything I learned from Bo Billy the Kid, I learned from the movie Young Guns.
And I don't know how accurate that one is, but yeah, we meet Billy the Kid, who is played by Dan Shore. Dan Shore was in Tron, Air Force One, Star Trek: The Next Generation. Doing research, I find a lot of Star Trek: The Next Generation with every movie that we do. There, that seems to be one of those ones that everyone has to take in a crack at Star Trek at one point. Most recently, Dan Shore appeared in Jessica Jones, actually. I have no idea who he was. I didn't even watch the most recent season of Jessica Jones because, of course, the show on Netflix that survives is the one I liked the least. I liked all the other ones. Luke Cage and Daredevil and Punisher, those were the ones that I loved, and Jessica Jones was the one that got an extra season, so whatever. So they see Billy the Kid, and we get the line, "He's famous, dude. Let's bag him." So they end up in a poker game that leads into a classic Old West bar fight.
Oh, one thing I did learn in a quick Google is he's wearing a cheater's pinky ring during that that bar fight. And that's okay. How they catch him for cheating. And so apparently Billy the Kid also wore a cheater's pinky ring.
What is a cheater's pinky ring?
Some sort of ring you wear on your pinky, I guess. But you're a cheater,
is it like you're forced to wear it?
So I that everybody look that everybody much at into the it. Table knows like you're a cheater.
It's like the Scarlet Letter yeah. of the Old West, or is it something where it like has something where you like a pin on the bottom side where you can poke a hole in the card so that you can tell which ones are the good cards.
Maybe. I feel like it has to have like a versatile use.
So okay, so
there's no way you'd out yourself as a cheater with a ring.
Yeah, but it's either a symbol of cheating or it's a way to cheat. Okay. they have this bar fight and they manage to escape, and all three of them escape into the phone booth, and they end up in Athens, Greece, 410 BC, where we're going to meet Socrates. But when they're looking up who might live here, we have Bill saying, "Oh, it's under Socrates." So one of those lines, they're still sticking to the Socrates. I love that. I love that it's, oh, it's under Socrates. You know, this is where Socratic method is from, but it's under Socrates.
And they also know that it's pronounced Socrates. They say it at one point.
Oh, at the end, yeah.
I'm pretty sure at the beginning, too, they say Socrates at one point, but they just stick to Socrates because it's easier. Okay. And it sounds more valley.
Yeah. Socrates is played by Tony Steedman. He's got 135 credits dating back to 1956. I didn't even pick any. And so Ted is sent up to philosophize with him. And he ends up quoting lyrics to Dust in the Wind. And who is it that sings that song? Is that Poison? No, I was thinking it's like Poison or,
Dust in Kansas. No?
Dust in the Wind. It's one of those 80s...
Yes, Kansas.
Yeah, Kansas? Yeah. So that's what he quotes to Socrates, and Socrates loves him, and now we've got a new travel partner. Then we end up in just generic 15th century England. Everywhere else, they've managed to land somewhere where there is something perfectly happening that they need, but this is just random 15th century England. And this is one of those points where I had to write down a line because I love it so much. See, you take a look at Bill and Ted have always been the founding fathers of these kind of stoner characters, you know. Like, people always say that Jay and Silent Bob are ripping them off. But I'm impressed, as I've watched it this time, just how intelligent they actually are. Like, stick with me here. The way that they speak, they actually use some very intelligent words and use them correctly.
Oedipal.
And yeah, and I'm going to get to that because that is my favorite line. But right here, Ted says to Billy the Kid, "Billy, you're dealing with the oddity of time travel with the greatest of ease." Like, it's just, I love how they talk because they're not the guys from Dude, Where's My Car? Like, yeah. they speak an intelligent way. And this is the only one that I wrote down, but, you know, like, all their most non-heinous. Like, for every one of those that they throw in, they've actually got some very cleverly written dialogue, and I appreciate that. But yeah, Billy is dealing with the oddity of time travel with the greatest of ease, and they decide to leave him to baby. They're always delegating tasks.
He's the one who picks it up, like, immediately. Like, the second they step out of the booth after picking up Socrates, he's just like, you sit here, Socrates, and you stay with me.
Yeah, yeah. He gets it, and their Socrates is being babysat, so they're always delegating babysitting duties on these historic figures. Mm-hmm. So Deacon is back watching Napoleon, Billy the Kid is watching Socrates, but so Bill and Ted go to explore, and they find the historical babes. Now, these characters bug me, because they, like all 80s movies, they don't have any decent female characters. Like, Missy is almost one of the best or strongest female characters in the movie. Like, these two characters are just such a waste of characters as far as I'm concerned. Because, like, they are so underappreciated that these characters were recast for Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. And then they were... Yep. Oh. And then they were recast again for Bill and Ted's Face the Music. And it's just like, okay, that's how little respect you have for these characters, that when we get to the end, we supposedly find out that they are even bandmates.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got Princess... And here's another example of how underappreciated these characters are, is when I was looking them up on IMDb, IMDb has listed them both as Princess Elizabeth. Like, they've given them both the same name. So the one that is actually Princess Elizabeth, she is played by Kimberly Cates, and Princess Joanna is played by Diane Franklin. Princess Elizabeth, so the real Princess Elizabeth, that's Kimberly Cates, and she is the subject of this week's Bit Player Spotlight. Born August 15th, 1969. 69, dudes, yeah. Kimberly Cates was born in California but grew up in Montana. Her biological father was killed by a drunk driver when she was a child. Kimberly was pre-med in college before winning a modeling contest, which brought her back to Southern California. She has 10 half- and step-brothers and sisters. Interestingly, for this subject from a time travel movie, on her biological father's side of the family, she has ancestor connections to Thomas Jefferson, Robert E. Lee, and Lee Marvin. So it's just kind of, I enjoyed the parallels with the time travel movie.
Founding father and Confederate general. Yep. Nice. Interesting. Yep.
She has appeared in numerous films and television series, including one of the first Seinfeld episodes, Larry Sanders Show, Charmed, Growing Pains, and Murder, She Wrote. Her first film was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, in which she played Princess Elizabeth, which is also, sadly, her best-known role. Yeah. She studied acting at the Beverly Hills Playhouse for 10 years with Milton Katselis. She has appeared in over 40 television shows and movies prior to becoming a full-time film producer.
Oh.
She is a founder and CEO of a publicly traded production and global distribution company called Big Screen Entertainment Group, which she also where she has also produced feature films for the company. I looked at some of these movies. I have no idea what they are. Some of the credits include Dirty Love, which is a Jenny McCarthy movie.
I was going to ask if it was a porno
movie. Nope. No, not porno. A movie called Mosquito Man. A movie called Babysitter Wanted.
That one's a porno movie.
Nope. None of them are pornos.
Okay. Just checking.
This one might be the porno, though.
Okay.
William Shatner's Gonzo Ballet.
That one has to be.
It's apparently, it follows a dance company that is actually putting on a ballet to William Shatner's music. I want to find this movie. I am going to end up looking up this movie. There's a movie called Airstrike, which actually stars Bruce Willis, Adrian Brody, and a whole bunch of Chinese people. Oh. So it takes place in, like, or maybe Japanese people. It's a war movie, and I think it takes place in some Asian country. And so we've got the two white people in the movie with the rest of these Asian characters.
Okay.
And she's also producing an upcoming Snow White project. Hopefully it's better than the Kristen Stewart one. Wow, I'm just dunking on Kristen Stewart today.
Yeah, that's two now. Jeez.
She's unmarried with no kids and currently lives in California with a large menagerie of animals. And that is BitPlayer Spotlight.
So she's a menagerie. Cat lady.
she's a cat lady.
Basically, yeah.
So they're in 15th century England. They hide in suits of armor and play Star Wars for a little bit. And Ted falls down the stairs. Bill sees him getting shanked with a sword and thinks that Ted is dead. And we get the line, "You killed Ted, you medieval dickweed," for this G-rated movie. But we find out that Ted managed to fall out of his suit on the way down. How?
Yeah, one thing, it took multiple people upwards of an hour to get a knight into his suit of armor. Like, it wasn't common sense. That doesn't exactly. It doesn't look easy to get into. It's definitely not easy to get out of.
And when you see them in these suits of armor, like, you can see their clothes hanging out of the back. So yeah. So it's like, how do you not realize that's an empty? There's no way. Mm-hmm. But whatever, it's a comedy movie, right? So we have to kind of suspend our disbelief for a minute. So they're excited that Ted's still alive. They hug, and then we get fag.
Classic.
Yeah. So this is problematic, I think. I know this is something that they do in the next movie as well.
Yeah.
It definitely was shocking to, like, I was watching this movie while I was taking care of my new baby and cleaning and stuff, and both me and my wife, we heard them say fag, and then we were both just like, what? Like,
and you drop the baby, yeah. And whoa!
Like, we both just looked at each other and we're like, you can't say that.
Yeah, I'm one thing I am curious about Face the Music, and so I am excited to watch it, is I wonder if they address that kind of thing.
There has to be a way they address it.
Like, they hug each other, and one of them is about to say it, and, you know, it's like, whoa, 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 you know, like, no, yeah, you can't say that anymore.
You can't say
that
anymore,
yeah,
bro.
Or, yeah.
Come on, that's most heinous.
Yeah, like, they must do some sort of callback where they acknowledge the mistakes that they've made in this. And really, like, you know, I usually dunk on some of these older movies for their lack of representation. Okay, they could have used some more women in this movie. They could have used some more persons of color in this movie. But this is one where it's just like, this is something that I think you have to address. This is really the thing that is the most blatantly
problematic
in the movie. I
feel like they won't address it.
They probably won't.
Yeah, they might like just scoop it under the rug.
I feel like they're just going to be new people. But they're going to be like, they're going to be like 30 years older.
Yeah.
I think, like, yeah, I mean, Keanu Reeves has this reputation of being, like, the nicest guy in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, like, second only to Tom Hanks kind of niceness. Yeah. And you kind of wonder whether he would step up and say that,
I feel like they would say that things are wrong, but it's like with everything, when you watch these old movies, it's like, it was okay then. Like,
yeah.
I know for a fact, like, I don't know, I don't want to get canceled, but I know for a fact when I was younger, I probably, like, said those same things.
So
it's just one of those things where it's hard. It's, to me, it's more interesting than anything to go look back and be like, oh.
This time capsule.
How the world has changed.
Because nobody flinches in that movie at that time.
No.
But it's like, nowadays, we go, oh that was
gross.
But even 10 years ago, if you heard that on a show or something like that, you'd be like.
I think 10 years ago, fag would have still been I think fag was not okay 10 years ago, but retard was still part of our vernacular back then.
I would be willing to bet, like, almost any sum of money that when that movie came out in the theaters and that line hit, the entire theater laughed.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and Bogus Journey, which comes out in 91...
They do the exact same joke. It must have hit home.
Exactly. It must have been a hit. So we get another. This is where I start quoting lines ahead of time. We get the royal ugly dude saying, "Take them to the Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden, excellent.
I just want to
execute them. Bogus.
I want to preface my being here with saying that I hate being a party pooper and talking about history in a stoner comedy. But the Iron Maiden wasn't real. As far as we know, it was made as propaganda to show people in the Victorian era that, oh, look how bad it was in the medieval era. They killed people with this spiky thing. But nobody, as far as we know, nobody was ever killed by an Iron Maiden. Well, they just wanted to reference the band.
They just had the foresight that, you know, when the people first invented the Iron Maiden then, like, yeah, however long ago it was that they made the history of the Iron Maiden. They had the foresight to know that, like, in 100 or 200 years that they would want to reference a band name in a movie.
Definitely. <Yeah.
laughs> and so they're instead taken to be beheaded. When they chop the ropes, like they tie their heads down and they end up chopping the ropes, Ted's, huh? It's so genuine. I love it. Like, the fact that he's just like, wait a minute. Like, why do I still have my head on? Like, his, huh? It's one of the most genuine reactions I've seen in a movie in a long time. I love it. But yeah, it's they get rescued by Socrates and Billy the Kid because they've been posing as the executioners. They get rescued.
Yeah, whenever that happens.
Whenever that happens. Yeah. Wait a minute, they've been gone for an awfully long time now. You know, maybe we should go make sure they're okay.
Socrates, smart dead dude.
Smart dead dude, that's right, he was. And then they get back, they end up in the future, like where Rufus is from. We get a little taste in here of Napoleon eating at the Ziggy Pig. This is where two of the waiters in there, they are the writers of the movie, Ed Solomon and whatever the other guy's name was. So the eat the pig, Ziggy, yeah, two of those guys are the writers of the movie. And so we get to see gluttonous Napoleon get his new Ziggy Piggy badge because he eats the pig. But yeah, in the future, the future scene is just a weird one to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't even understand the future. I think I appreciate the fact that with the futuristic scenes in this movie, at least, they haven't tried to invent technology that would be outdated by now. Like,
I kind of wish in Rufus's opening monologue that they would have done more to show, like, the history towards the future of Bill and Ted. Like, what happened and why they're so revered and, like, what great conflict came about that their music brought the world together.
While we're in the future, I just want to say there's some sort of authoritarian government that rules the future with George Carlin and those three guys that are sitting on the thrones
Even thrones? They seem to be like floating because they're bobbing up like and down. That. They're on some sort of like floating.
But it's those four dudes who are just like, we really like these guys' music. We're going to invent time travel and go back and make sure these guys stay together because for all intents and purposes, without that time machine, Ted goes to military school.
Yeah.
Like, they're creating this future.
Because the clock is always running. Don't you understand?
You're right. Because they made my brain is going to... It doesn't make any sense because they're operating in a future where they never split up.
Exactly.
But then something randomly is happening in the past without them knowing that it's going to cause the future to be in jeopardy?
Because the clock is always running.
The only thing that could have happened is they created their own future. Like but then their future would have never existed because how did they go back?
It makes no sense. In most Bogus Journey, they do the Terminator thing where they get an evil guy to go back and put an end to them, to stop them before they ever make that song or whatever. That's much more, like, that makes sense as a plot. This one, it's just, it's George Carlin going, I like these dudes' music. Let's make sure they stick together. So
maybe in Face the Music, they should have a bit where they actually go back and show you why.
Well, this actually, all happened. Yeah. What would have made more sense for the Excellent Adventure timeline is Rufus and those three dudes live in a world where the world is garbage.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, well, it all came about because we traced it back and it all happened because this kid all went to military school. So now we're going to go back.
So keep the reason we're not seeing the future, like we're just seeing this one blue room is there's like wars and Armageddon raging outside the doors.
It's a 3D set. If you step outside that door, there's just a bunch of wooden scaffolding and stuff. Like wow. They're all actors. All those people that step in to go rip on the guitar, all actors, all paid.
This is the problem with time travel movies. Like, you need to lock it up.
Yeah, you need to decide which version of time travel is the real one. They're in the future. They, once again, be excellent to each other and party on, dudes.
Party on, dudes.
And so they get back into their phone booth, and the phone booth squad, we now get rapid fire pickups for extra credit on their report. So we've got 1901 Vienna, Austria for Sigmund Freud, played by Rod Loomis. His profile picture on IMDb is from this movie.
It's the Sigmund Freud picture.
It's him, okay. Him as Sigmund Freud. So it's That shows how famous of an actor he is. He was on Star Trek Next Generation at one point as well, and the movie Beastmaster. Anything to say about Freud?
Nothing to say about Freud. A little bit of a creep, just in general.
We go to 1810, Kassel, Germany, for Beethoven.
Beethoven.
I do like the fact that when the time machine lands, he's playing for Elise on the piano, and it doesn't faze him, because Beethoven is actually deaf. Famously deaf, but remember that.
Exactly.
Remember that he doesn't react in this scene.
Big note that says famously deaf on my page.
He's played by Clifford David, who was in the movie Signs, Kinsey, he's a working actor. We then go to 1429. We're still in Germany. Okay.
1810, first of all, the castle that he was invited to, he famously refused to go because by 1810, he was so deaf that most people had to shout in his ear for them to be heard. Also, Fur Elise didn't come out until 40 years after he died.
Ah! Oh! See, we got the history buff on the show. This is awesome. Okay, so we then travel to 1429, Orléans, France, for Joan of Arc, played by Jane Wiedlin. I remember her most from Clue. She was the singing telegram in Clue.
Oh.
Interesting. Okay. A singing telegram. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Boom! She was in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, does a lot of voiceover work. Anything about Joan of Arc?
At the end, they talk about how she was like a warrior, blah, blah, blah. Joan of Arc did wield a sword on multiple occasions, but for all intents and purposes, she was more of an advisor, and said that she liberated France by the time she was 17. Sadly, died with most of France still under English control.
Okay. We travel to 1209 Outer Mongolia for Genghis Khan. I know that you mentioned something about this one. Genghis Khan, played by Al Leong, It might just be Long. I don't know. L-E-O-N-G. My apologies. I remember him in Die Hard. He's the guy that takes the candy bar out of the snack stand while he's waiting for the cops to break in. He was in Lethal Weapon 24, Big Trouble in Little China.
Jeez.
I know him from a lot of things. I know, discussions we had before we recorded, I know you had a big problem with the portrayal of Genghis Khan.
Well, he's very slapstick comedy and funny. When they first introduce him, definitely probably what Genghis Khan was like, women around him just chowing on meat or whatever. And
taking the women whenever he
exactly.
wanted.
Yeah. Exactly. He's famously known for raping most of Asia. Like, I forget the actual statistic, but there's something like 15% of people from Asia are related to Genghis Khan in some way.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah, no, he has an incredible lineage just because he banged everything that moved. But he turns into a very slapstick comedian by the end of it, where he's in football pads and he's swinging hockey sticks and stuff like that. Very funny, but this dude killed more people single-handedly than Hitler. So, big, big murderer.
Then we leave Outer Mongolia. We go to 1863, the White House, and we get Abraham Lincoln. Another person whose profile pic is from this movie. It's played by Robert V. Barron. Or maybe Barron. Well, there's two R's. Probably Barron. Robert V. Barron. He does a lot of voiceover work. And Colin might appreciate this one, because I know he likes animation. He does voices on Robotech and Captain Marlock and the Queen of a Thousand Years. I've never heard of that one. At least Robotech I've heard of. And he also did a lot of voiceover work on Power Rangers as well.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Classic.
So the antenna on the phone booth is broken, and like Chris mentioned earlier, this is where they are riding sideways in the phone booth now. And so they stop in caveman times to fix it. Ted has a backpack full of pudding tins. How much pudding is this kid carrying around on a daily basis?
Metal pudding tins, too.
Oh, well, see, that's the thing, though, is
well, I know.
You were born in 99, so this is how... This is how us old people used to have to get our pudding. Is we used to have to pull a tab. Mm. Yeah, we have to pull a tab and
I used to always just poke holes on the top and squeeze it and lick.
Nice. Why is this guy carrying around? Did he have the foresight to load his backpack with pudding because he? He knew that they were going
well,
to
need
Ted,
more. Well, it was Ted, right?
It was Ted that had
I'm
it.
I'm sure military father, he had him in the Eagle Scouts or something. Be prepared.
Always prepared. Okay, so yeah, he has
definitely don't explain it, but
he has all the...
It's all up there.
He has all the, the pudding tins, and they're all chewing gum and make a giant gumball to use as adhesive for these pudding tins, and they fix the antenna. They land in yesterday, and we redo the Circle K scene. Should I redo Sponsorship Corner at this time? With the line, that conversation made more sense this time, and Rufus tells them they gotta dial one number higher, because they only have 2 hours remaining before the presentation, because even though Ted reminded himself to wind his watch, he didn't wind his watch. Meanwhile, Deacon has taken Napoleon bowling, where he cheats. I love Napoleon the cheater. Oh my god, writing down the score of bowling.
Just like, putting a one in front of it, like nobody's gonna notice.
Yeah, and then he goes and bowls his turn. He ends up falling on the ground and banging against merde,
which actually means shit in French.
Which actually means shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
G-rated movie.
A G-rated movie.
Kids don't speak French.
No.
Not even French kids.
Kids can't read. Right? I've got a 7-year-old that has come such a far way this last year with reading abilities that I'm not going to show him a movie with that many subtitles of the word shit. Even if it's G-rated, like the
general audiences,
the ratings board definitely had different criteria back then. Yeah. We encountered the same thing with Goonies, where Goonies is a PG-rated movie, but for... Anyway, so, yeah, Deacon decides, let's ditch this guy, and Napoleon can't pay and gets thrown out by the owner of the whatever,
of the
owner of the bowling alley.
Which brings us to our next segment, which is, I wonder what happened to that guy. And today's issue of I Wonder What Happened to That Guy, we have Richard Alexander, who also goes by Dick Alexander. He played the bowling manager. He has a total of 6 credits to his name, but hasn't worked since 1990. So when we try to Google him, all I get is an author and a zoologist, neither of which are him. So we're kind of just sitting here wondering, you know, where is that guy?
So
what did happen to that guy?
Yeah, this is a legitimate question. What happened to that guy? If you know, tweet us.
Yeah.
We're worried about his well-being. We want to make sure he's okay.
Yes.
So a very literal definition of what happened to that guy. What happened to Dick Alexander? Someone let us know.
We just want a wellness check.
A wellness check. That's it. That's it.
But don't film it.
So Napoleon gets kicked out of the bowling alley. So now we're back to Bill and Ted. Bill and Ted land back in the present. They land on Missy's garden hose. Sorry, I mean Mom. Bill and Ted introduce everyone by the wrong name. I love that. I don't know whether this is something
where...
Not
even the wrong name, though. Doesn't he just, like, give them, like, a... This is Jimmy Socrates and...
Yeah, Jimmy
Socrates.
David Beethoven. So I don't know whether they legitimately don't know their names or whether they're trying to cover for the weirdness of the situation with
they're
Missy.
They're covering.
Yeah.
The last names are their real names.
But not all of them are.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. Maybe
you think they're just grabbing some people just out of time? They're just like, you look like you're doing something important.
Yeah, I don't know. They land back in the present. Missy says, okay, there's sodas in the fridge, but you have to do your chores. Even though, technically, shouldn't they be in school right now? Like, they're the last presentation
like
of the day.
Yesterday or tomorrow or...
It's today now.
Okay.
The teacher on his list has it that they're the last presentation of the day at 2:45 p.m. So we can assume that right now it is noon 45. So shouldn't they be at school? Why is Missy assigning them chores in the middle of the school day? Shouldn't it be, like, once you get home from school, do your chores? Like, are they...
Maybe she thinks they're getting home from school. Maybe that explains
the
weirdness.
She's just been laying in the sun all day.
It's an interesting find.
Maybe she's
definitely
just so used to them being slackers that she just...
Oh, yeah, you guys are home and bringing your friends by to party. Because Bill's house is obviously the cool house.
Yeah.
So they have to do their chores, and so we cue the William Tell overture while the historic figures clean the house and all learn about this new technology firsthand. And so we get a wacky fast-forwarded scene.
Gotta have a montage.
A montage.
It's a movie from that area. Gotta have a montage at one point.
Well, we've already had one montage, which that's them getting historic figures.
Of course.
This is montage number two, but it's a fast-forwarded one.
At this point in the movie, I was really wondering what these people were picking up and taking back to their own time. Like, because there's one point where Beethoven ends up turning on, like, a synthesizer, and, like, I wonder how that influenced his last pieces of music that he wrote before he died kind of thing.
Yeah. It does make you wonder whether they pocketed anything, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
They,
Billy the Kid seems like the kind of guy who would pocket something and take it back with him.
He definitely does. he gets a modern-day cheater ring. but you know, so we're presuming if they've only got about 2 hours left that they've started cleaning at about 12:45. It must have taken them 15-20 minutes minimum to do that thorough of a cleaning, even with that many people.
Well, not even a thorough cleaning. There's at one point where I forget which character does it, but when they're cleaning the kitchen, they just open a drawer and shove all the dirty dishes.
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah. but there's Windex is being pulled out. The vacuum is being pulled out. Like there is some
thorough
stuff going.
Makes me wonder what their chores are. Yeah. To begin with. Like, they really gotta clean that sucker.
But yeah. So, I would presume that it is now 1:15. So we've now got an hour and a half until showtime. Let's go to the mall! So we all go to the mall, and meanwhile, they all go to the mall, they abandon everybody in the food court. To watch each other, yes. This time they're all babysitting each other because they have to go find out what happened to Napoleon. So they go ask Deacon, and he says he ditched Napoleon because he was a dick. And he says, dick, G-rated movie. And where would you go if you were Napoleon in modern-day San Dimas, California? of course, Waterloo. Yeah. So he's on the water slides at Waterloo. Meanwhile, back at the mall, Billy the Kid and Socrates are hitting on girls until Siggy...
Definitely high school girls, too.
Yeah. And then Siggy comes up with his very phallic corn dog, and they call Siggy a geek. You know. Good old poor Sigmund
Socrates immediately picks up on, gotta love him. Yeah. Immediately geek. Calls him a geek afterwards.
Yeah. Genghis Khan finds a sporting goods store, and he finds an aluminum baseball bat, which he likes more than his sturdy wooden club.
Audibly laughed at the part where he swung the baseball bat and compared it with his club.
Yeah.
It was great.
And so, now this is why I wanted to bring up the famously deaf part of Beethoven. Beethoven finds the electric keyboards, and the guy that works at the store turns on the keyboards to show him what it does, and he reacts.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking underneath the keyboard to find where the sound is coming from. He can't figure out anything. So they did such a brilliant job of making sure that we knew that he couldn't hear. Everybody else that is listening to that piano concerto, they all react to the fact that something is happening outside, and he doesn't move a muscle, but now all of a sudden he can hear this keyboard, which is something that I do not understand at all.
Maybe
so,
he's just feeling the vibrations.
Well, that's reportedly how he wrote his last, like, Fur Elise, for example, didn't come out until after he died. That's reportedly how he wrote that music, but at the same time, like, the manager of that store or whatever is just having, like, a perfectly normal tone conversation with him. And the reason they're bantering back and forth is because he doesn't speak English.
Yeah. So it's one of those unfortunate inconsistencies because, like, I laughed a lot in this movie, right? I remember this movie fondly, and it's still so much of it got me. Lincoln gets his picture taken, and he's asked to return the Lincoln outfit, and cue pandemonium in the mall. We've got another 80s montage. We've got Genghis Khan tearing apart a sporting goods store. We've got Joan of Arc nudging aside the woman that's doing the
dancer size,
the dancer size in the Nautilus exhibit, you know. And so we've got all this pandemonium happening in the mall ice rink. I thought our city was the only mall that had that had an ice rink in it. But yeah, we've got Socrates and Billy the Kid on the ice and all this sort of thing. Pandemonium, everything's going crazy. Everybody gets arrested.
Everybody.
And so the cops are trying to figure things out. I love as they're going through showing how the different people are handling being arrested. I love that Freud is psychoanalyzing one of the cops and everything like that. Or Lincoln spelling out his name to Ted's dad, and Ted's dad going, I know how to spell Lincoln, you know. And so this is now where our time travel logic, which we've already established, is very flawed.
Very bogus.
This is where... very bogus. This is where it becomes brain-meltingly...
Yeah, I had a real problem with this.
So after our presentation, we're going to go ahead in time, or go back in time, to the time that your dad had his keys, and then we're going to hide them. Where should we hide them? Behind this sign. And then it was me that stole my dad's keys. And yeah, they have to go back and remember a tape recorder with a timer on it. This is the one, though, that really doesn't make sense to me, is the note that they type to themselves.
Yeah.
They're, you know, crawling around. They find on a typewriter a note that says, hey, good luck on your journey or whatever, and it's signed Bill and Ted, P.S. Doc.
Yeah.
So was there a timeline where they ended up getting caught by the guy walking by? How did they type Duck on this? Like,
well, see, okay, so even with the keys, I don't know if I missed something, but the keys are behind the sign.
Yeah.
But never before or after do I remember them taking the keys. Presumably, after the presentation and everything, they would have gone back and left the keys.
Yeah.
But there's a scene, and I thought it was really specific, in the jail later on, where Ted leaves the keys like on a
on the cell.
And I thought that was gonna end up being like a huge thing where they like break time apart and have to like go
because after the presentation they go back to before Ted's dad is looking for the keys, because like the third scene of the movie is when Ted goes home to grab something and dad is looking for the keys.
Yeah.
And then later on when Deputy Van, this is Deputy Van Halen down at the station, we found your keys. Right. So they're going back to a period of time before when Ted's dad did have the keys, which is why he's missing the keys
in the first place.
And this whole time they've actually been hidden behind the scenes.
Still doesn't make any
because
sense.
Future Bill and Ted.
But did they ever show when the keys get behind the sign?
No.
That's a problem.
But they're just magically there because they're remembering that that's where they're going to hide them, is behind the sign.
I felt like there needed to be a scene later on where they go hide the keys behind the sign and type up that letter.
I think this is bad. Watch Bogus Journey. The climax of that movie is not only them doing it, but the antagonist of the film also doing it. It's just, bonkers to try to keep track of.
That's true, absolutely. Yeah, and they have the tape recorder with the timer on it, the note that they type to themselves. It's just, the note makes no sense. And then the garbage can. Remember a garbage can. Garbage can.
And one just
magically appears that says Wild Stallions Rules on it.
But didn't it have a fraying wire or something like that, which means they knew how to cut into the rope?
Maybe. I don't know. Like, this is just, this is where the time travel logic just, it starts melting your brain. And all these things are remembered by two guys who couldn't remember to wind a watch.
Yeah.
So, you know, that in itself is a flaw right there. So the teacher is about to send everybody home because it looks like Bill and Ted are no-shows. But we get the last report of the afternoon. The lights go out in the auditorium. And I'm impressed with how important to the school these history reports seem to be.
Yeah.
Like, that they would fill the entire school auditorium to do these reports.
Like, I also want to say, like, you and I have both done, like, stage performances.
Exactly,
with lights.
As people of the theater.
Like, when did they, well, like, at what point did they have the time to send in these lighting cues?
Yeah, do they have their own tech crew that came back with them?
Well, exactly. Remember, after we're done our presentation, we gotta go back in time, hire some guys that can run the lighting board. So we end up with our other montage, though, our last montage of the movie. Yeah, and for some reason, Bill and Ted have suddenly become super smart. Because they know all the facts, they know them off by heart, they're pronouncing everybody's names correctly.
They did do a montage of studying at the beginning. Well, not even a montage. They had a book open at one point.
Yeah, but the whole time when they were actually meeting these characters for real, they still weren't getting their names right or anything like that.
Yeah.
Maybe being crammed into such a small space with all these people, they learned by osmosis somehow?
They're good on their feet.
They're good...
Socratic method.
So now it comes to my favorite line of the movie. This line absolutely killed me. I guess I have learned more in my adult life since my last viewing of this movie. Ted gets therapy. And then Freud asks if he wants to have therapy, and Bill says, or if Bill wants to have therapy, and Bill says, nah, I've just got a minor Oedipal complex. And I had never understood this line before. I didn't understand the story of Oedipus Rex or anything like that. Like, it's just something where it's like, the fact that, and again, it's the writing, it's the fact that Bill manages to say something that is so intelligent, even though he's this idiot. But my God, this line just absolutely destroyed me. I had to pause the movie to finish laughing because I had never gotten this line before. But every time he says Missy, I mean Mom, and all the jokes about Missy, they all lead up to this one joke that just, it slayed. It got me.
Slayed.
It was, the buildup was worth it. It just absolutely floored me. And somehow, like, not only are they experts on the history and they have all the light show and everything is working out perfectly, spontaneously everything is working out perfectly, they also have props. They have sword fighting equipment for Joan of Arc. They have, you know, a couch that they can just pull out. Like, is the drama department just storing everything backstage?
They had a map of France on a cork board for Napoleon and a bunch of wrist pieces or whatever for him to smack off the table.
So, like, I mean, it's an absolutely amazing presentation that they've got. But there's absolutely no way that it just happens like that.
It had to be worthy of an A+, though.
Comedy movie, suspension of disbelief. That's all that we can do. We close the show with Abe Lincoln ripping off his own speech of 4 score and
7 minutes ago.
7 minutes ago, but of course he ends it with "Be excellent to each other and party on, dudes." The auditorium goes absolutely fucking apeshit. Like, even more apeshit than the guy that said, "Sam Demas High School Football rules!" Colin is just over here shaking his head because, like, Chris and I have this movie memorized and he's seen it for the first time here. But, like, that's what I said. This movie meant so much to me that I still remember so many of the lines. So they get back into their phone booth, presumably to take everybody home and then go to the future or to the past to get keys and trash cans and everything like that. And of course, the auditorium, everyone has a lighter. Love that 1989.
Every single person
has a lighter. But to top it all off, I mean, nowadays it's cell phones being held up. I appreciate seeing lighters, but everybody has a lighter.
Everybody.
And we're back to the beginning, basically. We're back in the garage. They're jamming. They're trying to film their video. But Rufus reappears, and he reappears with the princesses.
Breaks time even further.
And so with what I was saying about the girls being disappointingly poor characters, this is where Rufus introduced us to something called the mall and things called credit cards. You know, because women be shopping, you know, like, it's 1989, women be shopping, that's all it is. Like, it's just I hate that the, like, Joan of Arc, she's our hero female character, but even her, she's underused. She's one of the first people that is picked up in the montage, so you don't even get a story of her beforehand.
All we know is she starts an aerobics program in France to help train the military.
Exactly. So it's just the women, it's just I feel bad for women in the 1980s because the women roles were garbage. Rufus wants autographs, and I love that even in the future, they still have CDs in this timeline of the future, even if they have, like, an animated cover, but it is still clearly a CD.
Compact discs, baby. They're the future, let me tell ya.
MP3s are gonna go away again, and it's gonna come back to compact discs. No more streaming. No, it's like people that collect classic vinyl. They're all going to want... We're going to bring back CDs as a retro thing. And he tells them that the girls might as well sign too, because they are in the band after all. And Rufus gives them guitars. He shows off his guitar playing skills. And then the rest of the Wild Stallion starts playing, and they're terrible.
Just awful.
But...
just the worst.
I love this scene because it... because it provides resolution, as it should, to, like, the very first scene of the movie where they're debating do we need the triumphant video or do we need Eddie Van Halen? And they finally just rest on
we need to learn how to play the logic loop.
They broke the logic loop.
Finally, it took them what? How long is this movie? An hour and 40?
Something like that. And we've got Rufus addressing the camera one last time and say, "They do get better," he assures the audience. And there we go, credits. And that is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Now, Colin and Chris.
Okay.
Doing this one backwards today, and you'll see why. On Rotten Tomatoes, It has an 80% on the tomato meter, so that's the critic score is 80%. An audience score, 376,165 reviews, giving it a 75%. On IMDb, the critics, the Metascore have given it a 50 out of 100. And the audience rating, do you want to guess?
100 out of 100.
Nope. Audience rating, come on, guess. Let me ask you something. What number am I thinking of?
69.
IMDb scores it 6.9 out of 10. 69% for Bill and Ted's. Classic. I hope that number never changes. No one else send a review on IMDb unless you're going to choose to give it 6.9 because that is amazing that Bill and Ted's has scored 69% on IMDb.
Awesome.
That's 108,000 reviews for that one. Where does this fall for you guys? Does it still hold up? What do you think? Do you agree with those particular scores?
I mean, for me, it's tough because, I don't know, just watching this movie, all I could think about is, like, this seems like the Jay and Silent Bob movie that never was. Because I love Jay and Silent Bob, and I can clearly see the influence that Bill and Ted had on Kevin Smith. But it's hard for me to, because I knew them first, to be like, to then look at this movie.
So you see them as ripoffs of Jay and Silent Bob instead of the other way around.
It's hard for me to forget, to remember that Bill and Ted came first, so they're not ripping off Jay and Silent Bob. But
well, see, it's almost like Jay and Silent Bob are the Bill and Ted that are implied.
Yeah.
Right? Because Jay and Silent Bob, they openly smoke weed. And
obvious
stoners. Yeah, they openly do drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas it's just kind of implied drugs. With Bill and Ted. Because they're more of a surfer dude kind of thing.
Like I think I've just seen... For me, it's an interesting movie to watch because I've seen so many movies that I love. Even Dude, Where's My Car? Like, movies that I love that clearly are ripping off this movie. So, I mean, that because of that, I have to give it, like... And I still think it's a good... It's a great comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it still holds up really well for...
Except for our hating on our LGBTQ community. That there's that one moment, but I think everything else is solid.
I also like it because it's such a simple concept.
Yes.
Sometimes I watch movies today and I'm just like, why are they trying so hard to create this, like, super, like, drawn out, complicated story.
Yeah,
like,
million plot twists. This, like, just convoluted tale, yeah.
Sure, the time travel is a bit messed up, but it doesn't really take away from how funny the movie is.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Oh, so. Yeah, I still laughed hard. And the fact that even though I've seen it, like, 30 times, I still managed to find a new joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. And Chris, what about you? Still hold up?
10 out of 10. I love that movie.
10 out of 10. Ooh.
It's great. It's fantastic.
Okay.
It's one of those.
Yeah, see, for me, if I'm honest, yeah, I'd probably hover somewhere in the 85, 90, not, you know, like,
I'd give it an 80.
I am up on, yeah.
If we're being real, I guess I'd be in the 80 range as well. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm in the top fifth of this movie for my where I would rate it. But, you know, there's a part of me though that thinks I gotta give it that 69. Yeah. I gotta give it well,
I give it 69 out of 69, which is 100.
There we go. Nice. There we go. There we go. That's Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and that is our show for this week. A big thank you to our special guest for this week, Chris. I hope you had a good time with us today.
I learned a lot, so.
Yeah. One last fact
I'm
for you.
I'm still shocked that the Iron Maiden isn't real.
Right?
Yeah. Well, Chris
one other fact for you. Waterloo Water Park. Funny name to choose because Waterloo was Napoleon's greatest defeat. The Battle of Waterloo in 1815.
Well, now, you could even argue that in this movie, he found so much fun at that water park to just be taken away. It was his greatest defeat right there.
Damn.
No? No. Okay. Anyway,
his greatest defeat was the bowling, wasn't it?
That's I guess so, yeah. He did get, like, physically thrown out with that one. Well, that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to go to Apple or Spotify or whatever app you listen to your podcasts on and just please give us 5 stars. Doesn't really matter what you say. You can say that, you can tell us 69, dude. That's all you have to put in there. But it's those 5 stars that are important and drive us up the chart and help us get noticed.
And if you want to get in contact with us, you can reach us by email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook on the I Used to Like This One Facebook group. Find us on Instagram at iusedtolikethisone, all one word, and at iusedtolikethisone with the numbers replacing the words on Twitter. Social media will be the place you can look to find what movies we're watching so you can watch them ahead of time.
You laugh, but there's a character limit on Twitter. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. Special guest this week, Chris Wells. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.
And party on, dudes.